This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
This is the moment they've been waiting for to roll back all the rights that have been won by people. And so that is why it is absolutely important that we are out here tonight and that we are fighting back to say, no, you will not take our rights. We are going to fight for them and we are going to win.
All across the U.S., people took to the streets to protest the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade.
The United States does not care about Ukrainian or Russian lives. They care about NATO expansion and economic domination. And millions will die in the proxy war because of these interests.
In Oakland, anti-war activists gathered outside Congresswoman Barbara Lee's office to protest her vote to spend tens of billions more dollars on the war in Ukraine.
And that's what the People's Summit for Democracy is about. Expanding democracy through the process and medium of revolution. Can we do that?
Yeah. And we bring you voices from the People's Summit in Los Angeles, held to counter Joe Biden's Summit of the Americas, which excluded Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Protests have taken place across the U.S. since the Supreme Court overturned the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that the Constitution guaranteed women's rights to choose whether or not to carry a pregnancy to term. Here are voices of people who took to the streets in San Francisco.
The decision that so many millions of women had made before,
and were continuing afterwards until today, made the decision to have the abortion. Because that was our right! And we knew that was our choice! And like many out there, despite all this propaganda that they say about women regretting them, I have no regrets. No regrets. And you know what, to go with what I think other people have been talking about the struggle is, you know what, I can say that I have two friends who have regrets. You know why they regret it? They wanted to have those children. But as people said, how expensive is it to have children in this country? One of them started cleaning up. She said, you know what, I'm going to give up smoking. I'm going to be clean. I want this child. And she said, there's no way I can afford it. And broke down. And how many people have been in that position where also the reason why they regret it is because they wanted the child that they could not afford. So as we've been fighting, that's why, you know, when we're talking about this, it's not just the right to abortion, it's the right to all reproductive justice, all reproductive health care. So that it's to have the abortion if you need it, it's to have access to contraception if you need it, if you want it. It's the right to that when you go in there, that you don't have $30,000 in debt from giving birth to a child, that you have support, that you don't have to struggle to get infant formula, because it's a majority of children during their first year who have to rely on formula. And who is it especially, who are the families who are most impacted by the shortage of infant formula, who are going to be affected by this ban? It's working class women, it's poor women, it's women of color. These are always the ones who get hit the hardest. And as it was said before, the rich woman will always find their way to another state to be able to get access. But those, I mean, I remember when it was happening, I don't remember, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when half the states half the clinics in Texas were closed. Sorry, that there was interviews of abortion providers in the other half of the state who were getting calls from immigrant women down on the border with Mexico who would call in and say, I'm pregnant, here's what's in my kitchen, tell me what I can take. So as people have already said here tonight, banning abortion doesn't ban abortion, it bans safe abortion. We knew that to expect this from the Republicans. We, as many people have said, yeah, there were 9 people who voted to remove abortion, and as it also got said earlier, that, you know, Clarence Thomas got on and said, this means all of these other rights we can come after. That we knew from even before this was happening that the governor in Texas was looking at, how can I come after education for immigrant children? That this is the moment they've been waiting for to roll back all the rights that have been won by people. And so that is why it is absolutely important that we are out here tonight and that we are fighting back to say, no, you will not take our rights. We are going to fight for them and we are going to win. And as many said, it's not just the Republicans. We expected this of them. Although I guess, you know, when it comes to the Democrats, we probably expected this from them too. But the fact that it's, you know, as it said, I was walking over here and I got the text message from Gavin Newsom saying, will you please contribute so that we can win in November? No. This whole thing has been waiting, that what they've been saying is, oh, you know what? Wait, you know, be patient. Or don't go out into the streets. Like, we're going to come up with a contingency plan. Everything that they've been saying, they've just been expecting it to roll back. And then they'll think about what to do afterwards. There was no mobilization of the people because that is not in their interest. That is in our interest, and that is why we are out here tonight. So I've said what it means, that this means millions of women across the country right now, about what it's going to mean for those who are also going to, I mean, I cannot imagine the struggle. So when I said that I got my abortion back in 2001, it cost me $300 out of pocket. I was 18. We had to borrow from a neighbor. To do it at that same moment right now is going to cost you at least $600. Who has that money? That I am not free while others are oppressed. That it's not just our rights as women, but it's for our other sisters and our siblings in struggle. That's why we are marching to join up with the Trans March, because we know it's not just women. It's other people also can get pregnant as too, and this impacts all of us. We know that this is targeting women, but we know they're going to come for everybody's rights, everybody that they can, and so that's why it's absolutely important that we are out there and we are uniting the struggles, because together, together, when we unite our fights, that's when we win. When we have each other's backs, that's when we win.
Those were people speaking out at a protest in San Francisco on the day of the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade.
I was done at 16, showing up for class. I was out there in the rain, learning how to kick some ass. I was done at 16, using my mama's key. It was all on me. It was all on me.
That was Play God by Annie DeFranco. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. On Thursday, June 23rd, people gathered outside Representative Barbara Lee's office in Oakland to protest her recent vote for $40 billion more for the war in Ukraine. The demonstration was called in conjunction with the International Day of Action for Peace in Ukraine, called by the Peace in Ukraine Coalition. There was a companion demonstration on the same day at the Northampton, Massachusetts office of Representative Jim McGovern, who also voted for the $40 billion, and accompanied House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on her recent visit to Ukraine. According to the organizers, quote, "This massive funding package represents a clear escalation of the war in Ukraine by the government of the United States, using the Ukrainian people as cannon fodder in a proxy war with Russia. The funding pours fuel on the flames of that war. It will prolong the war, resulting in thousands more Ukrainian and Russian deaths at the very least. And this funding is one more step in escalating and widening the scope of the war up to, and possibly including, nuclear war." Unquote.
My name is Aisha Mansour, and I am an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. We are here today to explicitly and unequivocally demand the end to U.S. intervention by financing wars abroad that benefit U.S. imperialist interests only. It goes without saying that the U.S. priorities are not saving the lives of the most marginalized. Just last May, the largest ever military assistance package was approved for Israel at a staggering $38 billion.
$38 billion
to finance occupation and genocide against a people without an army. It is not because the United States cares about the Israelis or Palestinians. It is because Israel serves as a foothold for U.S. domination in the Middle East, and it is in their best interest to financially support them at all cost. This war is no different. The United States does not care about Ukrainian or Russian lives. They care about NATO expansion and economic domination. And millions will die in the proxy war because of these interests. We are here today to force the U.S. government to confront its own global system of murdering lives for the sake of profit. Our lives, our lands, our families, our people are not collateral damage in the quest for capitalist profit. The anti-war movement in the United States has largely been silent on this issue, and it is because of the immense propaganda that we see put out specifically by the Democrats. Every single Democrat in Congress signed on to this $40 billion aid package to Ukraine. Barbara Lee, who prides herself on her anti-war activism, is now actively supporting U.S. interests in fueling war when it comes to Ukraine. This aid package implies the expectation of a long war. It is not for immediate relief like previous packages have been. And we as Palestinians can't help but notice how this package resembles the $54.5 billion package that was approved in 2003, the very first year of the Iraq War. It was also granted with the expectation of a long war. As we know, rather than allocating taxpayer money into useful programs that could benefit people here with education, housing, or healthcare, the U.S. would rather utilize billions of taxpayer money to fund proxy wars, dictatorships, and military regimes abroad. This is not shocking because the U.S. necessitates war, exploitation, and oppression as an imperialist nation to maintain its world domination. Whether it is in Palestine or the Philippines, the U.S. empire has laid its imperialist body all over the global south, from propping up and supporting neocolonial rulers and fascist dictators like Duterte, to arming the Zionist occupation forces that demolish our home and steal our land in Palestine and viciously abuse and murder Palestinians with absolute impunity. The support for Ukrainian resistance in mainstream media not only shows where U.S. economic interests lie, but also shows the deep-seated racist nature of this country. We, as Palestinians, have never had our resistance to occupation glorified by Americans. I cannot speak to you all today without acknowledging how infuriating this hypocrisy is. Americans are not questioning supporting resistance coming from Ukrainians, from white Ukrainians, many of whom are in Nazi brigades, while they have denied us basic human dignity for over 100 years. We, the PYM, stand with every single person across the planet fighting for their land and their home. And we demand that this grace be extended to us as well. We must end U.S. intervention, we must end these endless wars, and we must hold our electeds accountable when they support the death of millions for their own economic gain. To do this, we need to revitalize the anti-war movement in the United States. We cannot be shamed into silence any longer. U.S. intervention always leads to more death and destruction. Let me repeat that again. U.S. intervention always leads to more death and destruction. There is never an exception to that fact. Thank you for your time and your principled support for this pressing situation. As Palestinians, we know the U.S. government will never truly support and bring about freedom. We know our power comes from each other, from joint struggle, from people power, and our commitment to push from all angles against imperialism, exploitation, and oppression, so we, as all people, can take and stand against this war. Free Palestine, free the land, and free the people.
Next up, we have Bert from DSA.
There is no voice for peace in Ukraine, okay, in Congress. Not a single voice among congressional Democrats for peace in Ukraine. That's the situation we're dealing with. That includes Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Barbara Lee, Mark Pocan, on and on and on and on. Every single one of them voted for this damn war, okay? And I had some conversation with Barbara Lee's legislative director and also her district coordinator, who's supposed to be in charge of this office. This office is shut down today. The building is shut down. I don't know how constituents are supposed to get access to their elected representatives. But anyway, we're here. We're going to march over a little later to along Harrison there by the lake, so people see what we're out here for. Why Barbara Lee? Barbara Lee has done some good things in the past, okay? She was the lone vote in Congress against the authorization for the use of military force after 9/11, which was the blank check that was used to authorize every U.S. military action for the last 20 years, most of which had nothing to do with the attack on the World Trade Center. So she stood up at that time and she said, some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause, just for a minute, and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control. Okay, you know, you could take those words and apply them to this $40 billion that they just voted for. Talk about spiraling out of control, okay? I think World War III constitutes spiraling out of control. I think nuclear war constitutes spiraling out of control. I think continuing a war, this $40 billion is for 3 months worth of war. 3 months. Oh, we're gonna come back in 2.5 months for another 40, 60, 80, $100 billion. Who the heck knows? Merrick Garland, okay, who's the Attorney General. What is he doing? He's not trying to protect a woman's right to choose. He's not trying to protect the attempt of Trump and company to stay in power despite all the, quote, rules and laws governing how this process is supposed to work. He's in Ukraine. He's in Ukraine looking to prosecute Russians for war crimes. Well, look, if you want to prosecute people for war crimes, you don't have to start by going to Ukraine. You can start with George Bush. You can start with Dick Cheney. You can start with Bill Clinton. You can start with Barack Obama. You can start with Joe Biden. Those are our own homegrown war criminals. We don't have to go to Ukraine to process war criminals.
Those were speakers outside Congresswoman Barbara Lee's Oakland office protesting her vote to spend $40 billion more on the Ukraine war.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind disks, I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won, you want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
That was the Bob Dylan classic, Masters of War. On June 11, during the AFL-CIO convention, Frank Hammer hosted a panel about the AFL-CIO's international operations and their relationship with the CIA and National Endowment for Democracy. Former UAW 909 President Frank Hammer has worked in solidarity with injured General Motors workers in Colombia, where there has been an 11-year encampment outside the U.S. Embassy, and with Mexican GM workers in Silao. They recently won an election against the old corrupt union, CTM. Frank's brother worked for the American Institute of Free Labor Development and was assassinated during the civil war in El Salvador in the 1980s.
My activity began back in October of 2019 when I attended a conference of the Latino Workers Leadership Institute in Dearborn, where we had a Skype call with the GM workers in Silao, Mexico, and about, I want to say 50, 75 workers, many of them auto workers, from the Detroit metro region. This was taking place at the same time that GM workers, UAW GM workers, were out in what amounted to a 40-day strike in connection with the national convention. And the connection between those two, GM workers in Silao and the U.S. workers on strike, is that the workers in Silao, who made trucks just like UAW members make in Fort Wayne and Flint, they engaged in solidarity actions in support of the U.S. GM workers, which included rejecting overtime and also protesting speed up, both of which GM was hoping to make up for lost production by the GM strikers. It was a wonderful, lively exchange between the workers in the assembled in the conference room and the Silao workers, who, by the way, were huddled in someone's kitchen. And the conference raised spontaneously on the moment, somewhere between $500 and $1,000 in support of Cynthia or in support of the GM workers. After that, I and a group of Detroit workers, labor activists, began exploring getting visas for two workers, including Israel Cervantes, who was one of the leaders of the GM Silao workers. In early 2020, we were trying to see it by getting a U.S. tour and getting some of these workers to come to the U.S. so they can meet face-to-face with auto workers in the States. Their visas were denied, and shortly after that, we had the pandemic. So I've done this kind of solidarity work before, especially on behalf of another group of GM workers, this time the ones in Bogota, who in the hundreds were sustaining injuries, job-related injuries and disabilities, for which GM rewarded them with firings. And a group of 68 initiated the tent encampment that was talked about. This is only after pursuing every other avenue for justice. And they initiated an encampment at the U.S. Embassy. And the reason they had an encampment at the U.S. Embassy is because at that moment in time, GM was emerging out of bankruptcy, and the largest shareholder of GM was Barack Obama and the federal government. And they had this faith that appealing to the U.S. government and to President Obama would help to rectify the matter that had befallen them at the hands of GM. Needless to say, that didn't happen. It was also based on the terrible language in the free trade agreement with Colombia. And the upshot of it all is that their tent encampment has now gone into the 11th year. The tent is still erected at the U.S. Embassy, and they're still waging their struggle. At the end of 1 year of the encampment, 1 year, and after a heroic hunger strike by eight of the workers, the UAW and GM went to Bogota. And even though they fashioned something called a mediation, and you even had two federal mediators with them, it was a setup. And GM, as part of a so-called mediation, made a final offer. And the workers who were sitting at the table rejected it as not adequate, given that they were disabled and weren't going to be able to work, at which point GM and the UAW walked out of that mediation, came back to the States, and denounced the GM workers who are maintaining their encampment to this day. And Trumka had made a statement about them. The Solidarity Center there in Bogota, made appearances of that they were going to support these workers. And after that so-called failed mediation, where the workers rejected GM's final offer, all bets on this worker struggle were down. AFL-CIO no longer referred to them, neither did the Solidarity Center, and they were abandoned, including by the UAW. Work in support of the GM workers at Silao, Mexico, picked up during the fall of 2021. But this time, Labor Notes took it on as a project, along with the Mexico Solidarity Project. And while the elements of the planning was very similar, but the character of the project actually changed. It now included the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center, with the head of the Solidarity Center in Mexico, Jeff Hermanson, coming on the calls and playing a pivotal role. Our calls had grown approximately to 712 veteran labor activists, and it should be noted that I learned during this process that U.S. government was accelerating its attention to Mexico. And one indication of that was they now had four either labor or political attachés, I think it might have been labor attachés, assigned to Mexico, where normally there's only one. So by this time, the fledgling union at the GM plant in Silao, Cynthia, which I showed you earlier, was in the process of replacing the corrupt Confederation of Mexican Workers, the CTM, and it was clear that the Solidarity Center was playing an outsized role of support. And it was around this time, the same time, that Rob McKenzie published his book. He was a former Ford worker at the same time that I was a GM worker. He was at UAW Local 879. So he published his research on this historic auto worker struggle, which included the episode of 100 of armed thugs entering the plant during a major struggle, shooting nine and killing one brother. As the title of his book makes clear, his focus was on the role of U.S. labor and the CIA on what he calls the coup at Ford in Mexico. And by labor, of course, he means the role of the AFL-CIO, and specifically the American Institute for Free Labor Development, the AFL-AFIELD. McKenzie's work goes a long way to contextualizing the nefarious operations in Mexico of the Federation and its institute and support of the CTM thugs working in hand-in-hand with Ford management in suppressing the Ford workers' struggle. I should interject that McKenzie's book is of special importance to me personally, as he devotes an entire chapter to my brother, who was an AFIEL operative in Latin America for close to 20 years before he was assassinated in El Salvador in 1981. I say that only to say here that in the many years since my brother's death, I worked to familiarize myself intimately with AFIEL's role as part of the U.S. government apparatus, and had my own contentious relationship with the Institute and its director, William Doherty. I would urge workers, and especially auto workers, to read his chapters, not only about the role of the AFL-CIO in El Salvador, where my brother had been stationed, where the AFL played the role of dividing and suppressing a revolutionary peasants' movement, but also its role in the overthrow of duly elected leftist governments, especially the chapter about Chile, on behalf of the U.S. business class. As Rob's book documents, AFIELD operated in over 20 countries in our hemisphere from the early 60s until 1997, when the Federation, under the leadership of John Sweeney, disbanded it and two other foreign policy arms active in Southeast Asia and Africa. McKenzie reports that the year before it was disbanded, a staffer for AFL-CIO President Sweeney confirmed to him that AFIELD was involved in the suppression of the struggle by the Mexican Ford workers. Rob asked, did that include the CIA? And the staffer answered, yes. By 1997, the stench hovering over AFIELD, and by extension to the AFL-CIO, had gotten so bad, and the internal strife within the Federation had gotten so brittle, that AFIELD had to be carried to a cemetery and buried. The Solidarity Center, more formally the American Center for International Labor Solidarity, was its replacement. Although it was billed as a clean break from the past, within a few years it was spotted in activities reminiscent of its predecessor. The Solidarity Center operatives had infiltrated the labor movement of Venezuela as part of the attempted coup against the elected president, Hugo Chavez, who just happened to be socialist friendly and very unpopular with US imperialists, including the Koch brothers' oil empire. So the question raised already then was the Solidarity Center just old wine packaged in a new bottle? Could the AFL-CIO not have learned its lessons and failed to break with its project of taming militant and anti-imperialist workers, peasants, and political movements on behalf of the U.S. business class and its extensive holdings in Latin America?
That was Frank Hammer at a national panel in Philadelphia during the AFL-CIO convention, speaking about the AFL-CIO's collaboration with the CIA and the National Endowment for Democracy.
Bye.
And that was Class War by the Dills. You are listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. From June 8th to 10th, the People's Summit of the Americas hosted 3 days of art, music, speakers, debates, workshops, panel discussions, and performances to imagine a new world that puts people's democracy first. The event was held at the Los Angeles Trade and Technical College. Here's Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition speaking on the final day of the event.
Sisters, brothers, comrades, friends, it's not possible to think about revolution or radical transformation without thinking about it in the company of, in concert with, in solidarity with all of our comrades and friends, not just in Los Angeles, not just in the United States, but in Central America, Latin America, in Africa, indeed the entire world representing the fight against imperialism is here in the People's Summit for Democracy. I think it was so appropriate that we began this three-day event the night before it actually started, when Comrade Eugene Perrier, Abby Martin had an opportunity to confront Antony Blinken about the racism and colonialism, about the execution of Palestinian journalists by Israeli Zionists, snipers paid for by U.S. imperialism, that Antony Blinken came here, thought he was going to have it smooth rolling, and was confronted by the voices of the people who organized this summit. ...199 years ago, James Monroe issued the so-called Monroe Doctrine, announcing that the U.S. capitalist, slave-owning, ruling class was going to not only rule over North America, but the entire hemisphere. And 199 years later, as Biden tries to say who can come and who won't be able to come to the Summit of the Americas, we can say we're putting the final nail in the coffin of the Monroe Doctrine. Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution got the ball rolling. We're going to end it. Instead of the arrogance of empire, instead of the arrogance of imperialism, what we have demonstrated here in the past 3 days is the building of a dignified collective of resistance against arrogance and against imperialism. This is dignified. It's based on mutual respect by the rejection of racism and white supremacy and all of the manifestations of capitalist oppression, including patriarchy, including all forms of violence against women, the oppression and discrimination and violence against the LGBTQ community. We have built an organized and dignified collective of resistance that puts the working class at the center, because it's the working class that will make the new society. That's what we're determined to build. That's our goal. We are not trying to protest the system. We're trying to build a new system. The pandemic that began 2 years ago and has taken 5 million lives also created, in the same two-year period, 573 new billionaires. There are now 2,653 billionaires. 537 were created in the last 2 years. That's just about one billionaire each day. At the same time, around the world, there are 470 million people who still do not have access to bathroom facilities. Just think about that. 2,600 billionaires with a total net wealth of $12.5 trillion, people who do nothing, contribute nothing, do no work, have accumulated all of this money, this wealth, this power, and 450 million people have to go to the bathroom outdoors every day. That's what capitalism really is. It's not about celebrity culture and People magazine. It's this gross, obscene, bizarre, awful inequality that's bred and continues to be bred every day, every hour, every minute, and it will never end until we end it. Capitalism will be ended when we end it. The question is, of course, can we end it? And all right. Every revolution that takes place throughout history, every revolution, beforehand, people say, revolution is impossible. Radical change is impossible. The people are too apathetic. They're too tired. They're too preoccupied with the problems of everyday life. They can't think about big politics. They can't transform society. They're too busy surviving, or they're too scared of the state, too scared of the cops, too scared of the military. And then revolutions happen, and afterwards, everyone says, wow, we knew that was coming. That was inevitable. Because you can't have a society based on this level of inequality and oppression on one pole and extreme obscene wealth on the other pole without there being collisions and class struggle and revolution. And that's what the People's Summit for Democracy is about, expanding democracy through the process and medium of revolution. Can we do that? Yeah.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro addressed the People's Summit of the Americas by video link, also on June 10th.
There is a world beyond Washington. There is a world beyond imperial arrogance. And it is a world that is emerging. Dear friends of the People's Summit, here we are standing from the construction of a different world, a multipolar, multicentric world, a world based on dialogue and respect, on the equal treatment of states, of peoples, of governments, a world based on profound dialogue, a dialogue of cultures and religions, of dialogue that's inclusive of ideologies and positions for a new humanity. A new humanity is necessary, and it is being made. A new humanity is possible. That is why I congratulate all the organizers of the People's Summit in Los Angeles. Our voice has been there. As we said, the voice of the rebellious peoples of our America, of Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, has been in the streets of Los Angeles in the form of street art, in the form of women who have been repressed with flags, with slogans, with chants. They banned the march of the social movements because they were afraid of the color and the strength of our voice. But they have not been able to stop it. That voice is over there, over here. And it is a voice that's accompanied by a smile of hope that moves us, the hope for a new humanity. Without imperialist hegemony, without neocolonialism, without neoliberalism, a new humanity building a new social model, economic, political, and cultural models that allow to see ourselves person to person, face to face, that allows us to recognize each other as different, but also recognize each other as equals, recognize ourselves as brothers and sisters of all the peoples of the world. You learn much in these struggles. We are warriors of struggles, of all the battles. Now we have been on this Eurasian tour, but we are passing through Algeria, which is north of Africa. engaging in depth dialogue with governments, with peoples, learning from experiences of the responses and the public policies that are being implemented in different countries, and recognizing, seeing with our own eyes that there is another world out there. The world is much bigger than the dominance and arrogance of Washington. The dominance and arrogance of empire is in decline. And that we're still a hegemonic and dominant empire of the world and of our America. That time has passed. That time could definitely be canceled. We, the peoples of America, are choosing our own path. In diversity of creation and innovation, the diversity of struggles, of popular movements, that is why I want to thank you from the Bolivarian Revolution, from the socialist revolution of the 21st century, founded from the most genuine in the solidarity of love and Venezuelan peoples. We send all of you, all of the solidarity to the People's Summit of Los Angeles. Please know and be assured that Venezuela has resisted. Venezuela is moving forward and is recovering. Venezuela is standing tall, fighting and victorious. And the people united, victorious, overcoming threats, attacks, and the arrogance of unilateral sanctions, coercive measures, monetary, financial, economic, and commercial and political persecution, and building with the hands and the minds of humble people, and the working men and women creating responses that allow us to have our first year, 2021, of economic growth. And now in 2022, we are seeing the expansion of the comprehensive recovery of our economy, of our social rights of the people, of direct democracy, and in general of Bolivarian revolution of the 21st century. We are fighters. That's how we see ourselves. I am the workers' president. I am the people's president, the fighting president, a man who stands tall. I'm at the forefront of the revolution. Comandante Chavez put me here. And his voice will never be silenced. No one will be able to exclude us from the streets and from the struggles. There are those who, with their imperialist practices, hide from the truth by lying to themselves. No more self-deception. Here we are standing tall, ready to continue building this struggle, joining our efforts, moving forward, dear comrades of the People's Summit in Los Angeles, advancing towards a new America, our America, populist, revolutionary, and humanist, the America of the 21st century. Long live the People's Summit of Los Angeles.
That was part of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's message to the People's Summit in Los Angeles. Ethiopians have been in shock since hundreds, possibly thousands, of innocent civilians were massacred in an Amhara-populated area of Oromia Regional State, Ethiopia, last week. I spoke to Nebu Asfaw, an activist with the Ethiopian diaspora in Denver, Colorado, who organized a Denver vigil for the victims, one of many held in cities around the world. Nevyu, first I'd like to play the opening of a program that aired yesterday on Hello Ethiopia TV.
Okay.
Welcome to Hello Ethiopia TV Friday. It is with profound regret that we report that the death toll continues to rise in the Wolega, Ethiopia massacre. Some sources report that more than 1,500 people lost their lives. The majority of the victims are Amhara. Most of them were women and children. On Saturday, June 18th, the TPLF brutally massacred hundreds, possibly thousands. The senseless killings were executed by the TPLF's Oromo Liberation Front, SHAFE, in the Wolega region of Oromia.
I wanted to play that because we've been reporting on the war that the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, has waged against Ethiopia in the Amhara and Afar regions bordering Tigray. But this is the first time we've reported on OLF violence. Would you agree with this Hello Ethiopia anchor's description of the OLF as, quote, the TPLF's Oromo Liberation Front? And if so, why?
Yeah, I think the description is accurate, on point. The Oromo Liberation Army, or OLA, is a militant group that's undertaking an armed insurrection in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian Parliament last year designated it as a terrorist organization. And currently, there is an active campaign in the Ethiopian diaspora to get this organization designated as a global terrorist organization. This group, back in August 21, struck a military and a political alliance with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, and their aim was or is to overthrow the government militarily by taking over Addis Ababa, which is the capital city of Ethiopia.
Do you see a solution going forward?
Yeah, I think a lot is expected from the Ethiopian government to secure the safety of citizens, halting this targeted attacks against Amharas and other minorities in Western Oromia. And that includes declaring a state of emergency and having the federal military take over the area and administer it with a central military command. Because at this point, there's really no telling that the worst might yet be to come, right? And the safety of the citizens, particularly the Amharas that are being targeted, needs to be ensured. So I think that needs to be done is by the government to declare a state of emergency, the federal army to intervene and protect the citizens. But in the long term, what is not being done or what is not being talked about is the abolition of the ethnic federal system in Ethiopia and ethnic politics. The root cause of all this chaos is the ethnic federal system and the politicizing of people's ethnicity and tribe. And until that is removed, until that is replaced with a civil system, this kind of things are likely to continue to happen.
Nevyu, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you so much, Anne.
And that concludes today's edition of Covered Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers, Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.